Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. In this hour, we'll be spending some time talking about Russia and about its relations with its neighbors and its relations with the United States, certainly a subject that we have talked about many times before on the program. And the guest this morning is actually someone who has been on this program many times, although not, I think we've now decided, in about a decade. Our guest is Roger Cannet. He's a professor of international studies at the University of Miami. He was, for many years, a professor of political science here at the University of Illinois. He was a member of the Program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security from its founding until 1997 and is now an ACTUS faculty affiliate. While here at the university, he also served as head of the Department of Political Science, Associate Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs, Director of International Programs. He's here back to visit. He'll be giving a talk about the U.S., the European Union, and Russia, new strategic dynamics after Bush. And that will be this afternoon at 4 o'clock in the Illini Union. This is co-organized by the European Union Center and the Program in Arms Control, Disarmament, International Security, also co-sponsored by Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center. And I am assuming that anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome to stop by. This is 314 in the Illini Union. And, of course, here this morning on this program, questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, welcome back.
I'm very pleased to be here.
I'm glad to have you here on the show. Much has happened since the last time that we spoke.
Oh, yes, 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 yes. In a variety of different directions.
Yes. Well, to go back, I think perhaps the place we might start is to talk a little bit about how it is that particularly, I guess, here in the United States and perhaps also in Europe, they thought about Russia after the Soviet Union came apart and how they thought about what their relations with Russia would be, or if they really even had to take Russia into account at all.
I think that is the way they thought about Russia. And at least the Russians think that's the way they thought about Russia. By the late 90s, Russia had been in virtual free fall, both economic and political. Russia was on the verge of being a failed state. And Russia was treated as though it were on the verge of being a failed state. And I think the assumption was it was finished. It was washed up. One did not have to worry, so that the U.S., the West European countries, important ones, listened politely when the Russians were upset about this, that, or something else, and then went off and did exactly what it was they planned to do in the first place. They threw occasional sops to the Russians. They gave them they established a council for Russian-NATO interaction and then proceeded basically to ignore everything the Russians ever said. The miscalculation was that Russia would always be a failing or failed state, that Russia was going to join the Western community and follow through on what its stated foreign policy goals were back in 91 and 92, which it did not do.
Well, and certainly the Russians and the Russian leadership still had the sense that Russia mattered and that it was a great power, and that if at that moment it was diminished, I'm sure that they would have said, they did say at least to themselves and each other, that this is something that's only temporary.
Well, one of very early in the history of the Russian Federation, Mr. Yeltsin and his then foreign policy his then foreign minister, Mr. Kozyrev, were under great attack across the entire political spectrum for basically having abandoned an empire, for having pursued policies that were largely dictated in the West without having gotten anything meaningful in return. Mm-hmm. So that in the mid-90s, in the late 90s, when Russia was in dire straits, there were those arguing that Russia simply had to reestablish itself as a great power. That became the initial commitment of the Putin administration when Mr. Putin became president in the year 2000. Putin almost from day one said My objective is to reestablish us as a major world power. He put it in slightly different terms, but that was the message, and it was a clear message.
Yeah. What is the nature of Russian power now, and is it the same or is it in some way different from what it was when there was a Soviet Union?
Russia is nowhere comparable in economic terms, in political terms, or in military terms to the U.S. It was at one time, at least in the military sphere, comparable to the United States. On the other hand, Russia has in the last decade been able to put its domestic political house in order. One may not like the way it was done. It is clearly not a democratic political system, but there is stability. Things work. The economy is not only functioning, it has been flourishing. Much of that is the result of political decisions, of policies pushed through by Putin on the political side. Mm-hmm. On the economic side, Putin lucked out. The growing demand for oil and gas, the fact that Russia has oil and gas, Russia has benefited fantastically. But not all of Russia's economic growth, as one sometimes would be led to believe reading the U.S. press, is oil and gas related. World Bank issued a major report early this year that pointed out that as late as 2004, Russian economic growth was driven primarily by oil and gas. In the last 4 years, the expansion of consumer sales, the expansion of industrial production represented now significantly more than half of the growth. What the current global financial crisis and the plummeting of oil prices in particular will do is another matter. But the economy is back to a very substantial degree. Russia's neighboring states, the former republics of the Soviet Union, are all very, very highly dependent upon Russia for energy, for gas, for oil, for electricity. And the Russians have not been loath to use those as foreign policy tools.
Yeah. I certainly would have said, and I think it would be correct, that during the time when Mr. Yeltsin was leading the Russian government, that the relationship between Russia and the United States was positive, and that when things seemed to turn sour was during the Putin era.
But early in the Putin era, they were positive too. I would argue what all of the issues that divide Russia and the United States in 2008 were serious differences in 1998. The issues are not new. The way in which Russia is responding to Western policies and Western criticisms is what is new. In the 90s, a whole series of issues arose. Western policy, U.S. policy in ex-Yugoslavia, first of all in Bosnia, later and more importantly in Kosovo, NATO expansion, the early stages of discussion in the U.S., even in the Clinton administration, of anti-missile defense system. Mm-hmm. All of those were very, very serious issues. Yeltsin walked out of a major meeting over the issue of NATO expansion, for example, but there was little the Russians could do in 1998. The early meetings between Bush and Putin, recall, Mr. Bush came home and he had looked into he had seen
famously
a soul. he didn't quite say soulmate, and there were all these issues were divisive issues in 2002, so that Putin agreed that the U.S.-Russian relationship, despite these differences, was a very positive one. What's happened, I believe, is Russian political elites, Putin and those around him, basically decided 4 or 5 years ago that they could achieve their objectives independent of what they viewed as kowtowing to both Washington and Brussels. And I'm using Brussels as EU headquarters. And they've gone off their own in their own direction. They have so the issues, the outstanding issues are not significantly different from the ones of 6 or 8 or 10 years ago. It's been a Russian decision that they simply do not have to capitulate on all of these. In 97, 98, they were strongly opposed to NATO expansion. NATO expanded, and there was little Russia could do. In 2004, they were strongly opposed to NATO expansion. There was little that Russia could do. 2008, NATO is, at least the U.S., is strongly pushing NATO expansion once again. And that's not the primary reason for the intervention in Georgia, but it obviously was part of the package of things that set Moscow off in August.
Hmm. Well, one could understand that certainly the Russians have their objectives and they have what they feel are their interests, particularly in what they have always and still regard as their sphere of influence. And it seems that in these cases, it's case after case after case, where the Russians had their interests and the United States was as if they were saying, yes, well, we know you have your interests, but we don't care. Our interests trump yours. Do the Russians actually really have much leverage in this power struggle?
In their immediate neighborhood, they have a lot more than we do. They have let me spend just a couple of minutes on this issue.
Yeah.
In August, soon after the invasion of Georgia, Mr. Medvedev announced the Medvedev Doctrine, if you will. It sounds an awful lot like the Monroe Doctrine. Now, he didn't use these terms, but what he talked about was longstanding special interests, sphere of influence, as you're referring to. Hmm. I would argue that U.S. policy, Condoleezza Rice's objections notwithstanding, has explicitly for 15 or more years incorporated a lot of containment of Russia in it. By the end of the 90s, the Russians are looking at Americans mucking around in Central Asia, military facilities in a variety of countries in Central Asia. They are looking at the U.S. and the European Union actively supporting groups in neighboring countries like Georgia and Ukraine, which the Russians themselves don't favor. They favor other groups. They also, and you don't have to be a brilliant analyst to come to the conclusion that U.S. efforts to ensure that oil and gas pipelines are built to bring gas in particular from Central Asia to Western Europe that avoid Russian territory. The U.S. has been pushing alternative access to Central Asian energy that does not depend on transport across Russia for the last 15 years. And the justification is in part, it reduces the probability of Russia's being able to dominate a very, very important energy field. Now, you're sitting in Moscow, and all these things are happening, and you perceive them, I think, I know I would, as an effort to isolate, to contain. Now, in this entire region, Russia has far more going for it than we do. The U.S. has been successfully removed as an active player in Central Asia. Since August, the Russians have negotiated treaties with all of the major gas producers in Central Asia, and we're talking about Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, that call for vastly increased export of gas from these countries through Russia, presumably to Western Europe, so that even though one of these pipelines that the U.S. has pushed has been built and another is under construction, The Russians have not been frozen out of that. In fact, in recent months, they've had great advantage. They also exercise very strong influence over neighbors because they dominate their energy. Virtually all of the energy consumed in the Western neighbors of Russia comes from Russia. Long before the military confrontation in Georgia, Russia bought up virtually the entire domestic energy distribution system in Georgia. Not necessarily was it sold voluntarily. It was sold to pay off what were legitimate debts. The Georgians had not been paying the bills for gas and electricity deliveries. And there were these constant back and forth. And the Russians finally worked out a deal whereby the debts were wiped out, in return for which Russian firms, which are private but closely associated with the president, these firms, in fact, the current president was the head of one of the major Russian, the administrative board of one of the major Russian gas companies. So Russia's position in its relationship with its peripheral, with the periphery, is much stronger than that of the U.S. I think the invasion of Georgia had something to do with Ossetians and Abkhazi, the minority groups, but it had an awful lot more to do with sending a message to Brussels and to Washington: we're tired of your doing what you have been doing in areas that we view as extremely important. And I think Russia is in a very, very strong position in these areas, in this particular part of the world, stronger than the United States is. And there's very little the U.S. can do without improving the overall relationship and somehow convincing Russians that everybody isn't out to get them. That's hard to do when you have individuals who start out being perhaps semi-paranoid when it comes to security issues, but then on top of it, they look at what is going on, and one clear interpretation is we're not paranoid. It's actually happening.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Roger Cannett. He's professor of international studies at University of Miami and is emeritus professor of political science here at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, where he was on faculty from 1973 until 1997. He's here visiting the campus, going to give a talk, I'm sure, touching on many of these same subjects this afternoon at 4 o'clock, talking about the U.S. and the EU and Russia and anyone there, I'm sure, who was interested in stopping by and hearing what he would have to say can do that. Of course, here on the program, if you have a question, you have a comment, that's welcome too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'd like to talk a little bit more about the recent conflict going back this summer between Georgia and Russia involving South Ossetia. And it seems a little difficult to understand, maybe because it operates on several levels. It has to do with the government of Georgia and the people who live in this area of Georgia who say, we're not Georgians and we don't want to have anything to do with you, and their identification with Russia. But then it also has to do with this. It also has to do with apparently a personal dynamic between Mr. Saakashvili and Mr. Putin, the leaders of Georgia and Russia. And then there's this other level where, as you have explained, what Russia is wanting to do is send out some very strong messages. But to take it on the smallest level, what was it that Mr. Saakashvili thought he was going to accomplish when he sent troops into South Ossetia? And what did he think that the Russians were going to do?
That's probably the most important and also the almost most unanswerable question. It's hard to imagine a rational individual with a ragtag army, even though the U.S. had been spending some time and effort trying to train it, challenging the Russians, whose relationship with Georgia had deteriorated dramatically over the prior 2 years. Unless he really thought someone was going to back him up. Now, they've disappeared from the media, but there were reports in August of, well, first of all, regular weekly conversations between one of the presidential candidates in the U.S., a senior senator, and Mr. Saakashvili, whom our Senator McCain claims as a good personal friend. Saakashvili is a U.S. educated individual. He went to Columbia University. He knows all the buttons to push to explain his position in the U.S. Georgia did a wonderful PR job in the U.S. The Russians did a horrendous PR job in the U.S. So that during the confrontation, the story we heard was a very one-sided one. But there were this report. I have no idea what the content of the conversations was, nor do I have any idea whether the reported meeting between Mr. Rove, of former chief advisor to the president, supposedly met with him while on vacation in the area sometime early this summer. What messages was Saakashvili getting from official as well as unofficial sources in the U.S.? One thing is clear that to me, that he expected some kind of backup or support, whether it was based on misinterpretation, purposeful that's not at all clear. Yeah. But it's almost impossible to think he could have gotten away with a fait accompli, which incorporate the territory. This is a particular conflict that's been real since 1991. When the Soviet Union disintegrated, Georgia was already in the midst of a civil war. In the final years of the Soviet Union, when nationalism began to explode all over the country, Georgia had the great misfortune of having a rabid Georgian nationalist who happened to be a historian. Academics are not necessarily the best of political leaders, who, for all practical purposes, says Georgia, the new Georgia is a country of the Georgians. Now, 30% of the population were not ethnic Georgians. 30% of the population were scared to death of what Mr. Gamzagurdia was going to introduce. And the secession in South Ossetia, the secession in Abkhazia, occurred way back then. Mm-hmm. It was supported by the Russians way back then. And over the 16-17-year period in between, this conflict continued. It was not an active military conflict, but it was an issue of very significant importance. The Russians and the Georgians obviously had this information. The Russians had amassed troops during the summer of 2008 along the Georgian-Russian border. Back to your question, how did he think he was going to accomplish this? I'm not sure.
It seems to me that the questions are significant. They don't get asked because then it makes it look like you're somehow you're blaming the victim. You're somehow excusing the Russian response, which I certainly wouldn't do. But I think that has always been my question. And the other question I had was, what exactly did the United States government, the Bush administration, know? Did they know what Saakashvili was going to do?
I don't know. I don't think any of us know. The whole question is what were the discussions leading up to this? If they knew, why was he not strongly discouraged? There's all sorts of questions of this sort. And I don't think there's an adequate answer to any of them. I mean, he must have – I cannot imagine that the U.S. was not aware of the Russian military buildups. We supposedly are aware of anything happening virtually any place because of satellite imagery, so that one would assume that information had been shared. One would assume that there were discussions between our ambassador at a minimum and members of the government about what was the possibility of occurring. The other thing that is most interesting is the way in which the Georgian attack on South Ossetia occurred. The Russian arguments that there were thousands of deaths are absolutely and totally out of line. The data now seems to indicate about 100 people were killed in those bombardments. But a massive bombardment of the capital city of this, really an overgrown village, there's only 75,000 people in the entire territory. So it's not exactly a large population group, but the attack on the city and the mass bombing is an unusual way to reassert control over part of the country. The whole set of events is, there are those who argue, and I think there's good evidence, that the Russians may well have set him up, figuring what kind of an individual he was. But independent observers now maintain that the initiation of hostilities that the Georgians claim, namely that South Ossetians shot into Georgian territory, that there's no concrete evidence that that happened. So that the stories still, 3 months after the events, there are multiple stories. The stories do not coincide. And the Russian story does not hold up more than partially. And the Georgian story doesn't hold up more than partially. So that it's very difficult to say exactly what happened, when, and who was responding to whom.
We have a caller here. Let's talk with them. We'll welcome others. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Champaign County is our first caller right here, line one. Hello.
Hi. Very stimulating, and I'm glad you're focusing on what really happened. I had a couple of other things to bring up, and I don't know if you'll treat them. I was looking again for the famous Kennan quote. Kennan, architect of the containment policy, is quoted at the time of the expansion of NATO in the late 90s as saying that expanding NATO to former Soviet near abroad, might be expected to have an adverse effect on the development of a Russian democracy and to impel Russian foreign policy in directions decidedly not to our likings. And he called it expanding NATO would be the most fateful error of American policy in the entire post-Cold War era. Now, between that and the looting under Yeltsin, I don't know if you're following this RICO case, but Russians aren't just acquiescing in the looting. They're suing the Bank of New York Mellon for something like $28 billion. It's not a big bank. So it actually owns half share in the Georgian bank, too, which is a peculiar phenomenon as well. I don't want this to be reduced to any kind of conspiracy analysis because I think that it didn't take much to get Shashkashvili to do what he did. But, in July, third week of July, I guess, there was the Yalta 4 meeting. I don't know if you happened to attend that, but Karl Rove did, and so did Shashkashvili. So it seems to me that this triumphalism of the late 90s is still very present in the likes of the advisor to McCain and Schoenemann. And I'd like for you to react to some of that. I'm sorry for not formulating more as a question, but please.
All right. Well, go ahead.
I was reading this morning in my room. I'm teaching a course on Russian politics and reviewing material for class next Tuesday, and was reading specifically about the economic collapse of the 90s and the way in which rampant corruption occurred, and recalling the role that U.S. and other Western liberal economic advisors, market economists, were recommending to the Russians to privatize, and the absolute total disaster that occurred in Russia at several levels, disaster level one, and this is what I think you're referring to in your question, the vast majority of the immense wealth of the Soviet state ended up being pocketed by relatively small numbers of individuals, some of whom had contacts with Western individuals who were being paid to advise on economic matters. Some of those individuals apparently didn't walk out of their advisory capacities unrewarded. And many, many Russians, I would say a vast majority of thinking Russians, blame much of the looting of the Soviet treasury, if you will, to the West. And some go so far as to say it was purposeful, meant to destroy Russia's future. But you don't have to be that quite that hostile to come to a conclusion that Western economic advice, which played a role, they weren't the decision makers, obviously, but Western economic advice was not beneficial in the medium term to the overall economic welfare of Russia, and that the West played a very important role in the emergence of the so-called oligarchs, the individuals who, I mean, Russia has multi-billionaires, and they started from zero, most of them, in 1990 or so. They've done extraordinarily well, and most of them did extraordinarily well during this process of privatization, redistribution of the wealth of the state when Russia decentralized. So that the U.S. and the West more generally, but the U.S. is usually the target, is viewed as a participant in the collapse of not merely the heights of the Russian economy, but the standard of living of the vast majority of Russian citizens, that the West is partially implicated in that. The West has systematically tried, so the argument is, to freeze the Russians out of their legitimate interests in what they used to call the near abroad. These are the countries immediately to their west and southeast. So I think the points that you were making or implying in your comments are well taken. And what's probably most important is that is the way in which the relationship is viewed by most thinking Russians, including clearly those who are making policy. That those who are making policy, they're focusing on the security foreign policy aspects, and almost all of them view it in this way. Whether it is an accurate, totally accurate perception is not nearly as important as the fact that this is what is influencing policymaking.
Did you want to follow up?
Well, there's still just so much, but I'm wondering whether you know about the case against the Bank of New York Mellon, and it just seems to me that the fact that we don't talk about basic differences, we talk about Georgia and it's misrepresented as you characterize, but there's just so much else going
on. That I don't know the details of that one, but that's one of the cases of charges that Western financial institutions played a role, an active role in the looting of the Russian treasury. I mean, that's they were charged, if I'm not mistaken, they're charged with complicity in the transfer of funds that flowed out of the old Soviet system into the private hands of those who took it over, and Western banks, and this one, if I'm not mistaken, is precisely charged with being involved in that process. Am I not correct?
The caller rang. I want to kind of move on, and so
sure.
I will do that. I want to thank the caller. Invite others if you have questions. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus, and our guest is Roger Cannet. He teaches now at University of Miami. He's professor of international studies, and for a long time he was on the faculty here as professor of political science. And in years past, we had many conversations about the Soviet Union and U.S.-Soviet relations, and we're pleased that he's here visiting. He's going to give a talk this afternoon at 4 o'clock, and we're pleased that he could spend some time with us again after all this time. He'll be talking on U.S., EU, Russia, new strategic dynamics after Bush this afternoon at 4 in the Illini Union, 314. So anyone who's interested can stop by. To return just for a moment to the conflict between Russia and Georgia, I think that there are some people who have said that there was in Russia, in looking out at the surrounding territory, was thinking about in what ways can they gain little footholds here and there. And that they made a very deliberate strategic decision looking at places like Abkhazia and Ossetia where there were separatist independence movements, where they have gone into those people and sort of brought them into the Russian fold, said, we will support you. The people in South Ossetia have Russian passports. So the Russians could say, hey, we're protecting our own here. That's why we're becoming involved. And so one wonders, are there little landmines like this that the Russians have planted elsewhere that could blow up in a similar way?
Nothing quite like this. Hmm. Georgia is particularly important because it is the sole passageway for these gas pipelines that can bring – I mean, the U.S., in trying to limit access or to limit the Russian role in the export of gas from Central Asia has a minor problem that we don't want it to go through Iran either. So that the passageway is this narrow one off the bottom at the bottom of the Caspian Sea. You go through Azerbaijan. Now you can't go through Armenia because Azerbaijan and Armenia are, for all practical purposes, at war with one another. Mm-hmm. So you've got about a 20-mile corridor where Azerbaijan meets Georgia, and that is where the pipeline goes through. And that virtually is on South Ossetian territory. I mean, it's within miles of the South Ossetian border. There is a third pipeline planned, a major one. One wonders what effect a war in Georgia in August will have on investors who are looking for a long-term future return on investment. In particular now, since I mentioned before how the Russians had sort of snookered the United States in Central Asia, they've got all the deals at that end. But they've done something similar in the West. They have signed major agreements in the last 2 years with Germany, Bulgaria, and Italy for the production of new pipelines that will go, one of them, from Russian territory under the Baltic Sea to Germany, thereby ensuring that the Russians are not dependent on the goodwill of either the Belarusians or the Poles. They have signed a second agreement for a pipeline under the Black Sea that will go from Russian territory to Bulgaria. The Italians are part of that deal because they're going to pay for much of it because the gas is to go eventually to Southern Europe in particular. So now this became one of the major issues within the EU itself. The Poles and other East Europeans were extraordinarily angry with the Germans for, in effect, going off and signing a major deal, avoiding all of the collaborative institutional framework of the European Union. The European Union, when it comes to foreign policy, even in the field like energy, simply does not exist. The European Union as a single foreign policy actor is a fiction, despite the fact that 18 years ago everybody signed agreements on the establishment of a single collaborative common foreign and security policy. It does not. It is not working. On the issue of relations with Russia, the EU is greatly divided, with most of the former communist states being strongly opposed, supported by the Brits and, of all people, the Swedes. The Swedes were among the most active supporters of Georgia. So you've got very interesting dynamics occurring within the European Union. The same divisions within the EU that have become very visible in the last half dozen years on relations with the United States. All of the East European EU members or NATO members were strongly supportive of U.S. policy with regard to Iraq. These are the same ones that are very concerned about EU relations with Russia because they focus on what they view as the bullying, the assertive policies that Russia has initiated in relationships with a number of neighbors, not just with Georgia, but also with Ukraine, with Estonia, with a number of other countries, including Belarus, which is not a democracy.
We have another caller here. We want to get them in and make sure we do that before we run out of time. In Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. I wonder if you'd comment on a development in the in Eastern Europe that to me seems to be aggravating the Russians. It's the installation of the anti-ballistic missiles in Eastern Europe, supposedly to counter the threat of non-existent Iranian missiles, but which would seem to have a much more useful purpose in countering a second strike from the Russians if the U.S. were to initiate a first strike. Is this the interpretation the Russians give it?
Yes. And I didn't update my list of major issues between the Russians and the U.S. They include continuing expansion of NATO eastward. They include now much more than in the late 90s. The missile defense system that the U.S. is in the process of establishing, because that precisely is the argument that the Russian military present. It's the argument that Mr. Putin presents. It's the argument of Mr. Medvedev, the current president. So that NATO expansion, the missile defense system, are probably two of the three or four most important issues that divide the two. And that is one that on which the Russians simply will not accept the U.S. explanation. And you may recall that in response, the U.S. response was, well, we'll let you come and watch what we're doing and sit and monitor, which was then vetoed by our Polish and Czech allies, which obviously then feeds into part of the Russian concern that the new NATO members from Central and Eastern Europe are a major problem for the Russian relationship with the EU more generally, but also with the West in addition to this. So yes, this is a very serious, from the Russian perspective, a very serious issue. They simply do not believe Americans when they are told that this has absolutely nothing to do with Russia.
The Russians may have a degree of paranoia, but in this case, it seems more rational than paranoid, doesn't it?
Well, what the U.S. is in the process of building, at least stage one, would probably have no significant benefits even in dealing with a counterstrike, a second strike capability on the part of the Russians. The Russian arsenal is so immense still that we're probably 50 years away from a defense system that might, even in a second strike situation, be able to accomplish much. So that I tend to think at least the current group of leaders in the U.S. don't see this as a realistic beginnings of something with regard to Russia. But I understand fully why the Russians perceive it as they do.
Even though, of course, they have never been able to successfully intercept a free launched missile.
Yes. Well, it may be 100 years before.
But it's still a danger.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. But I think your point is a very, very important one.
Well, thank you.
All right. Well, we're down to the point where we have a couple of minutes left. You know, here in I suppose, a lot of the Western media in the last couple of years, there was a – Mr. Putin got a lot of attention because he was coming to the end of his presidential term, and there's a term limit, and there was all the speculation about, you know, would he somehow engineer it so he could continue to be president? Would he step down as president but continue to be involved in government? And I think everybody said, well, of course he will. It's just a matter of how. And we now know, yes, he stepped down as president. He became prime minister. Russia has another president, his junior, Mr. Medvedev, who sometimes when I see the two of them together looks like a little boy with his dad somehow to me. But are we to assume that essentially now still Mr. Putin, he's the guy who holds the reins of power?
Well, there's no evidence that it has really been fully turned over, nor is there any evidence of disagreement between the two, so that it may well be a useful, functioning tandem. Medvedev was functioning as a key part of the Putin team for the last 4 or 5 years, so that I'm not at all sure that there is a lot of difference between them were Mr. Medvedev actually to assume greater power. But it's very, very clear that Putin is still most likely the dominant voice. There are no differences between the two individuals. And I've read some reports that Putin likes to have a lot of hands-on, and he may well be having more fun as prime minister than he was as president, because in that position he actually has – he's involved in the operational elements in a way that the president in Russia is not. But there's no evidence whatsoever of a cleavage. And who is on top and who is not is probably not a very important question, because they seem to function very, very well, at least externally. From the outside, they look like they function very effectively together.
You know, one of the things I still remember that you said in one of our conversations long, long time ago, when there was still a Soviet Union, said that maybe one of the problems with the ways that we thought about the Soviet Union was we focused too much on personalities. We just looked at who were the guy, you know, on the day when they had the parade, who was the guy that was standing up on the reviewing stand. And we, to some extent, you know, perhaps we're still doing that because we're talking about Putin, we're talking about Medvedev. And having said that, though, I'm not exactly sure how you do other than that?
Well, it's hard. But there, obviously, Putin, let's focus on Putin. We'll go back to just, but he represents a very important segment of the decision-making processes in Russia. And this is not a single individual standing out there by himself. Any American president who could get the popularity ratings, and these, I think, are legitimate. These are not fraudulent. He pulls at the end of an 8-year term. Can you imagine an American president at the end of 8 years getting 70-75% approval for the vast majority of his policies? So that Mr. Putin is clearly not a Democrat. He accomplished much of what I referred to earlier through means that were unconstitutional in the context of Russia. They did not take into account civil or human rights issues, yet he solved a lot of very serious problems. And for that, he rated extraordinarily high on the vast majority of Russian citizens.
And how much does that have to do with his, I think, determination to continue to keep Russia strong and have Russia be seen as strong?
Extraordinarily important. 80%+ of Russians supported the invasion of Georgia. And anecdotal information, discussions with, you know, Ivan on the street indicated that people, I mean, they're really enthusiastic about the fact that Russia is back. Here's clear evidence that we cannot be walked over the way we've been walked over for the last 15 years. Now, this doesn't augur necessarily very well for the short-term, medium-term future of the relationship between Russia on the one hand, the United States on the other. If I'm correct, if the Russians have basically come to the conclusion we can accomplish our objectives, we don't need the West. And they've been saying that. Russian diplomats have been extraordinarily vulgar in their dealings with Western diplomats. Apparently, they've been using terminology that was not even used among the diplomatic corps at the time, at the height of the Cold War. That doesn't say a whole lot about the immediate future.
Well, there, we will have to stop. We've come to the end of this time here. However, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, Roger Kennett, he'll be talking this afternoon as part of a symposium on U.S.-EU-Russia, New Strategic Dynamics After Bush, starting at 4 in room 314 of the Illini Union. He was for many years here on the faculty of the University of Illinois. He is an emeritus professor of political science here at the U of I and now is teaching at University of Miami, where he's professor of international studies. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Appreciate it.